Expressing your love can look many different ways, and with the right jewelry gift from Blue Nile, it can truly sparkle. Blue Nile's collection of classic diamond jewelry makes for the kind of gift that speaks volumes without saying a single word. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, Blue Nile's diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, the monthly Times Radio Focus Group, where we ask real voters their real views on Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer, and most importantly, Rishi Sunak's trainers. It's a great listen, unless you're the Prime Minister, to be honest. Before that, in The Columnist, Manveen Rana and Matthew Syed on whether Keir Starmer, 30 points ahead in the polls, really needed to invite Natalie Elphick into the Labour Party. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Now, there was a time when Martin knew who he wanted in office.
Hello. Now, we are in the run-up to a general election, but really, for me, there's only one choice, and I choose Labour.
Yeah, that was when he liked Ed Miliband. But then Martin got chatting by the photocopier with Jane and Fee yesterday.
I'm giving it a bit of a swerve at the moment, and that's not just, you know, that's not because of my opinion of Keir Starmer. It's just because my opinion, my own understanding of the world is, I think the best thing I can do for myself and for people is to probably stay out of it more.
Although, of course, if he's going to win, Keir Starmer does need to win over the Swindon lot. So it's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult. Some breaking news this morning. Exciting announcement. Our weekly exit interview series with MPs standing down at the next election has now been extended into 2026 because there's so many to get through. After the news, Nadeem Zahawi is also standing down, bringing to an end an extraordinary political career. The MP for Shakespeare, as he likes to tell us, Stratford-upon-Avon. He was a children's minister, a business minister, the vaccines minister. Then he became Education Secretary, where he backed Boris Johnson.
Honestly, I'm the Secretary of State for Education. I'm a member of the Cabinet. I don't recognise that language about red meat or big dogs. All I can say to you is the Prime Minister's focused on dealing with the big issues. Levelling up is incredibly important to him.
Then he said that Boris Johnson should go. Then Boris Johnson made him Chancellor.
The Prime Minister has won the vote of confidence. I think it's only right that he's then allowed the space to deliver.
Then he said Boris Johnson should go again.
And I sat with him. I said to him, look, I've known you for 30 years. You know, they're going to try and humiliate you, and I can't bear seeing you being humiliated.
Then he ran for the Tory leadership.
This is a dangerous time. And I think I am best suited to be able to steward the economy through this and, of course, look at where we can help more.
Then he backed Liz Truss, who gave him this top job.
My role as the chief operating officer, as I call myself.
Then he called for Boris Johnson to come back again. Then he backed Boris Johnson, who gave him a job. Then he had to quit because of his tax affairs. So we can't necessarily rule out the possibility that Nadeem Zahawi might change his mind and announce that he is, in fact, standing again at the next election.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Yes, we say a very good morning to Manveen Rana. Hello, Manveen.
Hello.
And this week's Matthew is our Times and Sunday Times colleague, Matthew Syed. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, very well.
Nice. Excellent.
Nice to have you. You know, just the sun's out, so everyone's a bit more chipper. Now, I want to talk about, well, there's sort of two things are going on. The Labour Party have got a 30-point lead in the latest YouGov poll for The Times. Obviously, we don't focus on just one poll. We look at the trend, but the trend seems to be going in one way. Did, therefore, Keir Starmer need to throw open the door to Natalie Elphick? From, there's no other way of describing it, the right of the Conservative Party jumping across to the Labour Party. This is what the Education Secretary, Gillian Keegan, had to say about it on Times Radio this morning.
It's baffling, really. It's, I mean, she's really to the sort of right wing of our party, you know, ERG member, Big Liz Truss supporter. You know, I just can't see a good fit at all. But I guess... you know, her views and Keir Starmer's views change as often as their principles and policies, I guess.
I mean, does seem to be genuine bafflement. Manveen, it's interesting this, because while we've been talking about it, we've had lots of messages. Some people saying this is a... so there's two examples. Brian says, the decision by Starmer to allow this total right-wing nutter to defect to Labour is a disgrace. I question his decision-making. This will obviously alienate a fair number of Labour supporters. Then Kev says, I think most people just see the headline, Tory MPs defects to Labour and won't be interested in the details. Politics is all about being in power, not people shouting from the sidelines. What do you think, Mavi?
I think he's banking on that second version of it. You know, he's banking on people seeing yet another defection and thinking, well, that's a triumph. But there are very serious questions to be answered about what his party really represents, if it's able to take in quite a broad church, which includes people who are still sort of, you know, an Angela Rayner and a Natalie Elphick at the same time. I mean, what is that party? What does it represent? It's rather unfortunate that it seems Natalie Elphick put out a leaflet against Keir Starmer the day before she defected. Clearly, her decision-making was very sudden. But, you know, it's the sort of thing which is, again, a bit of a political own goal. You know, if I was the Tories, I'd be quoting that leaflet back to him every time you stood up now. I mean, it seems completely mad.
Yes, it's great.
It's not much of a triumph as a defection if it's constantly used as a tool to sort of whip you, really, because everything she said about Keir Starmer up until the moment she defected is... couldn't be more negative.
Yes, and literally the day before, this leaflet to her constituents accused Labour of having no plan and taking Britain back to square one. It said Labour backed uncontrolled immigration, but the Tories were taking action to stop the boats. And 24 hours later, she claimed that Rishi Sunak had not stopped the boats, record numbers of small boats arriving, and he's abandoned the centre ground. Not that anyone necessarily thought she was on the centre ground in the first place. Matthew, what's your reading of this?
Well, I don't think it's that interesting, really. It's really a question of political tactics, isn't it? I think we've got such big issues as a country, whether it plays well in this constituency or another, it's not going to affect how Keir Starmer governs. It's not going to change the policy platform or the manifesto. It's not going to change the trajectory of Britain. I mean, it may, on the margins, change the size of the majority. I think it's about as uninteresting. And I mean, I guess from a psychological point of view, the question is why she did it. Is it, you all know more about this than me, Matt, but did she think she's going to lose her seat as a Tory and wants to go to the House of Lords?
Standing down anyway.
Standing down anyway. Will she get a seat in the Lords or something like that?
But they all say she hasn't been promised one.
Well, that could be a euphemism, couldn't it? For we can't promise you, nudge nudge, wink
yeah,
wink.
Obviously,
you know how
not
these conversations
you,
go. But honestly, I think it's breathtakingly irrelevant in the sense that it's one MP on a particular day recognizing what I think everybody knows, which is Labour's going to win a landslide. The really big question is what will Keir Starmer doing government to address some of the very big challenges we face, number one. And number two, a very interesting question is what happens to the Conservatives after the general election? In which direction will they go? I mean, that will partly depend on how much they're hollowed out and the composition of the MPs who remain in the House of Commons. But I think it's an intriguing question about what happens. I think they really have struggled to define themselves for quite a long time. There hasn't really been a clear vision. And I think they do need to have a bit of a break and a bit of time to themselves. I think this has been a terrible administration over the course of the last 14 years. Really, really poor. Maybe the worst in post-war history. But I do think we do need a good... The Conservative Party can be a very strong force for good in this country. But it hasn't been that for a while.
And you do need a strong opposition. You know, there is a horror of getting a massive landslide on one side and having nothing in Parliament really holding it to account. But I think it's a really interesting question. It will depend on which Tory MPs manage to hold on to their seats and whether you end up with it lurching even further to the right for a generation, in which case, you know, they just won't really be much of a power in British politics. You can sort of see them going the way of the Whigs, you know, they'll vanish. Or you know, will they realise that this is a moment, a bit like they had with Cameron, where you know that you've got to lurch to the centre and look modern if you want to be elected again?
Well, interestingly, I think some people have done research on this and trying to sort of plot where Tory MPs are on the you know, the political spectrum. And it's not as straightforward as you might think. The further, you know, the bigger your majority, the more likely you are to be, you know, more right-wing and traditional and Tory safe seat and that. It does actually seem as if the party doesn't change, assuming that the swing is is uniform and the, you know, you just work your way down through the list. It does seem as if the party basically ends up much of a muchness. It's not sort of taken as a given that it lurches the right. I do wonder if it does tell us a bit, though, Matthew, about... I do take your point that ultimately it's not going to change the outcome of the election. There are times when Keir Starmer makes small missteps that if he was 30 points behind in the polls, we'd obsess about far more. It does tell us a bit about what he might be like in government and, you know, the decision-making process and his ability, because he could be in government with a medium-sized majority, but that majority including, you know, John McDonnell and all the people on the left he's been winding up and angering the whole time. It doesn't take much for that majority to become quite tricky, and his ability to manage his own... At the moment, he's riding high in the polls, he's going to be Prime Minister, it's fine, bring in Natalie Elphick, everyone's happy, or not, as the case may be. But at some point, he's going to need all those people who are really, really cross today to walk through voting lobbies for whatever it is he's got planned.
Yeah, on tactics, you can see that one would have thought, well, it's going to be embarrassing to the Conservatives if a Member of Parliament crosses the floor of the House just before Prime Minister's questions. There'll be headlines and it will give the sense to the public who are not very attuned to the minutiae that the Tories are still in disarray, but on the other hand, will alienate people who don't like her policies particularly. I think people will forget that by the time of the next election. She'll be out anyway, and I think it will make no difference at all. But I do think Starmer himself doesn't yet really know what he wants a Labour... They're so keen, and I totally get this. If you've worked all your life and you want to be Prime Minister, it must feel so tangible and so close that they just want to do everything to win the election. I'm not clear in my own mind what Labour will do in power. Just the other thing, Matt, when you were talking about left and right and where Conservatives are on that spectrum who might keep their seats after the general election... Did you feel that that left-right distinction has any credence anymore? I mean, what would be on immigration, you can sort of imagine right wing is less in favour of mass immigration and perhaps slightly harder on asylum. But what would that mean in terms of what Brexit should look like, how we should structure taxation, what we do with nationalised industries, what our foreign policy should be towards China, alternatively towards Russia? How we see our... Seems to me that I go in different directions on all of these based on how I feel about the particular issue and how it fits into a wider platform. It seems to me the left-right distinction is ever less meaningful today.
And actually, and also, but particularly true in the Tory party, and maybe that's because, like you were saying, over 14 years, we talked about this on How to Win an Election this week, because they've had so much chop and changing, there isn't a core narrative that has sort of all signed up to. And you're right, you know, you have someone like Miriam Cates, you'd think is on the right of the party, who with quite traditional social views, but then is quite statist on like banning things and, you know, state interfere. And you're right, trying to place them on the spectrum.
AI,
is
net zero. Yeah. You know, how do they feel about these totemic changes? It seems to me you could... how one feels about one of these issues, as you were implying, Matt, in no way predicts how you'll feel about some of the others.
Yeah, no. Luckily, it wasn't me who did the research.
Well, you're getting sort of unusual coalitions of sort of people who agree on certain matters, but we haven't come up with a system that defines that in the way that we did with left and right in the past. I think it feels like it's a moment where actually politics is changing profoundly, but the party system doesn't really represent that.
And I suppose actually a functioning political party would normally mean you knew what the party stood for because the leader had spelt it out, which is quite hard to say that either of them have done that at the moment. And then everyone falls in line behind because that's what you do in a parliamentary system with a whipping process. But part of the reason why we can't work out what the Conservatives or the Labour Party stand for is because everyone thinks it's whatever's in their own head. Regardless. So let's take the idea that nobody else has set out what they think they should be doing, but Matthew has. Matthew, you wrote a manifesto of sorts for the country. We don't have time to go through them all, but let's pick through some of them. Imagine a world without income tax or corporation tax. We should move to a land value tax instead. On the NHS, a social insurance model with private sector input and a wider shift from cure to prevention. And on planning, ends NIMBYism, build more houses and stop planning laws getting in the way. Let's bring in Dan Corey, who's a former head of the Number 10 policy unit for Gordon Brown. He's now at the think tank, the new philanthropy capital. Hi, Dan.
Hi, morning, Matt.
Now, I know you've read all of Matthew's ideas. Do they work? Are they a bit too, as yes, they would say, yes, Prime Minister, a bit too courageous?
They are courageous. I mean, people have thought about these things. It's not that people haven't thought about these things. And there's all sorts of problems with them. Some of them are political. I mean, would you get elected if you said these things? Would you get re-elected if you did these things? And some of them are practical. You know, it sounds great. Let's just scrap. And most people, fantastic. Your manifesto said scrap income tax. Blimey, people think that's rather good. But bringing in land tax is very difficult, very complicated. It's also kind of weird world. It's why no country, or no sort of major country has ever done anything like this. The idea that people who are on nice incomes are not sort of paying more tax for people on lower income. So, you know, you can do things towards it. If Matthew's a little bit less courageous, he might say, let's reform council tax, let's bring capital gains on housing and things like that. So you'd be taxing land a bit better. But the full thing, unlikely anyone's going to pick this one up, Matthew, I'm afraid.
Can I respond to
yes,
that?
Yes, please,
Matt?
Do. That's what you're here for.
Thanks. I think we've got to change the tax system in a fundamental way. You're right. Singapore have a land value tax. Australia have had a version of it. It works extremely well. It's backed on left and right. The Adam Smith Institute and the Institute for Economic Affairs on the right and other left-wing think tanks just as strongly the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And the reason is it is a highly efficient tax. If you tax income and capital, you get people working less hard. It's distortionary. But if you tax land, you do not reduce the supply of land. The supply of land is fixed. The value of unimproved land in this country is over £6 trillion. Our GDP is just over £2 trillion. It is an enormous tax base. There would be some transitional difficulties, but let me make a prediction. And I'm glad we're getting a chance to discuss this with a policy wonk. If the UK introduces this, there is consensus that growth would increase dramatically. This would help almost everyone. The only real losers would be the big landowners. And by the way, I happen to own a reasonable amount of land. It would affect me negatively. I'm not saying this in any personal capacity. I will predict that within a decade, all other Western nations will have followed, and it will be a source of amazement that we didn't do it earlier. The fact that it hasn't been done so far, and there are political challenges, I totally acknowledge that, is not a reason not to do it now. Otherwise, we'd never have had the Industrial Revolution. The US only introduced income tax at the beginning of the 20th century at the federal level. We must change, and the UK is drifting. We're going to end up like Argentina a century ago if we don't make radical changes. Tax is one of them. Human rights is another. I think we need to change energy. And I hope Starmer is bold.
Wow. Manveen, what do you think? Stirring stuff for Matthew.
Very stirring. I don't know. You know, as with so much of economics, it comes down to behaviour, and you can't always predict how behaviour will respond to such dramatic changes. You know, the transitionary problems would be around people who, you know, the elderly who aren't earning an income but have land, and you'd have to sort of force them to change their behaviour and effectively no longer be owners of land or their own homes and maybe sort of become rental, you know, rent more, it would have an impact on the value of land and property, which might be a good thing. I mean, that might be exactly actually the correction we need for young people to be able to get onto the property ladder, because as that tax stands, young people probably wouldn't be paying tax. They have an income, but very few of them actually have any land. Whether that would fix itself, if you're taxing land, would they want to become landowners? Do we become a society of people who rent, or does that then, you know, I mean, there are sort of so many other impacts that sort of follow on from it, in that, you know, would you get to a point where everybody's so busy renting that actually it becomes worth owning land and, yeah, and being taxed on it all over again? It's an interesting idea. It's really hard to know how it would all pan out in a country where we've, you know, in the past been very big on property owning, and therefore we have a generation who are sort of sitting on property effectively, are not very keen to sell it, but at the same time don't have a source of income coming in to be able to necessarily pay the taxes. I mean, it would be such a huge revolution in the way that people live. But you know what I mean? So much of this comes down to behavior and how we all respond to those changes. So it's quite hard to see how it might all play out in the end. But it's good to think about sort of doing things differently. I mean, if they're not, you know, we are, as Matthew says in his piece, we are at risk of becoming a smaller economy than Poland's soon. We've got to change something. It's just what, you know, what would be the most effective way of increasing productivity and leading to growth.
And on the, Dan, on the that question of, put aside the actual ideas Matthew makes, the fact that big, bold, radical ideas, which may or may not work or take a long time to come to fruition, have sort of fallen out of favour. You know, we've got a Prime Minister who's, one of his biggest ideas has been putting chessboards in parks rather than, you know, rethinking the way that the country is run. But if you're in number 10, you're trying to weigh up what can you do quickly, what will start all the horses, what will get you re-elected. How do you make those judgments about how bold to be?
Yeah, no, I, it's a really important question. I mean, it's a take an issue. I think, Matthew, you haven't got a solution to this one, but which is about social care. And a government is going to have to do something pretty radical on this, because we're all going to have to pay some more somehow through our sort of inheritance or whatever. And unfortunately, the Labour government that I was an advisor to a lot of only started thinking about it right at the end. And if you want to do something bold on social care, if a new government gets a big majority, thinks they might be in for two terms, I think you have to think you're going to be in for two terms to do this. They need to move on that and make it. And it won't be popular. And there will be people be unhappy, because there's always losers. There's gainers, but the losers always make much more noise than the gainers. So you have to do that. And equally, I mean, if you want to change public services, I wouldn't change health in the way that Matthew suggests, but we do need some change in a lot of public services. You have to get that going pretty quickly and understand what you're going to do. I mean, famously, you know, Tony Blair said he wished he'd spent a bit more time in his first term reforming public services, although there was a lot of change, things like minimum wage that came in right at the beginning. So I think you need a mixture of old stuff. But change, in my view, doesn't just happen from these big, bold, sort of, you can see them from hyperspace kind of moves. It comes from a new government making every single decision, and governments have to make hundreds of decisions every day. If you make them in a different way, in my view, with Labour background, in a more progressive way, you do change the way the country works, the way the country thinks about it, how society works. Yeah. So you need a combination of the two.
Thanks very much for that. It's Dan Corwee, the former head of the Number 10 Policy Unit under Gordon Brown. Manveen Rana and Matthew Syed then. Of course, you can listen to Manveen on the Story podcast, wherever you listen to this, and catch Matthew Syed in the Sunday Times. Up next is the Focus Group.
Every day is filled with opportunities to express yourself. And with an everyday piece from Blue Nile, you can do it without saying a word. Blue Nile's collection of diamond jewelry is the ultimate statement, with sparkle that elevates any outfit. Or switch things up with a sapphire piece sure to spark conversation. Either way, their diamond guarantee ensures you get the highest quality at the best price. Express yourself with Blue Nile, the original online jeweler, at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The Big Thing.
Every month here on Times Radio, we convene a real-life focus group of real-life voters to assess how the government's getting on and what matters to people outside the Westminster bubble. Last week, the local elections appeared to support what the national opinion polls are telling us. Labour on the up and like to win the next general election. But in our focus groups, we can look behind those headline polls and find out what is driving those votes. As ever, the focus group was run by former number 10 pollster James Johnson from JL Partners, who joins me now. Hi, James.
Morning, Matt.
Right, let's start with the disclaimer, as we always do. What is a focus group and what is it not?
Absolutely, Matt. So a focus group is not intended to be representative. It's not a poll. It's not intended to say what X percent of people think or Y percent of people think. It's there to give a sort of sense of what's going on underneath the polls. And that's a really, really important caveat, because people can listen to this and they can say, oh, goodness me, you know, eight people think this. What a load of nonsense. Actually, that's not what we're trying to say. This is to get into the sort of the texture, really, of what's going on underneath those polling numbers.
So who was in the group this week?
So we spoke to a mix this time, Matt, of people who have switched from the Conservatives in 2019 straight over to Labour. That's about half the group. And the other half of the group are people who voted Conservative in 2019 and now undecided or going to Reform UK. So a real mix that gets at the heart of what's really happening in that churn in the polls. And we went to three key swing seats. We went to Esher and Walton, Bury South and Wakefield.
Very good. Well, let's just dive straight in then. This is, as we always do, you kicked off by asking how this group of voters think the government is doing.
It don't matter which government it is. I don't think any of them do a good job. Cost of living payments, £300 here and there's lovely. But if you're a family with three kids, that's a couple of weeks shopping and that's it. It's gone.
I think they need to stop being naughty little schoolboys and maybe they'll get their job done a little bit better. It's silly little things like throwing garden parties during lockdown. Do your job instead of covering your ass.
They've recently spoken quite a lot about the fact that all the decisions they've made is reduced inflation rate, and inflation has reduced. But what has the government detailed what they actually have done to reduce that?
I think, unfortunately, I think things are going to explode and everything's going to go to before things are going to get better. And it's going to be some hard times coming up.
Before, the prices were going up just crazy. Now they seem to not going up so much, but everything shrunk. There's like five crisps in a bag of crisps.
Drives me mad, that.
I'm not saying things aren't hard. They are. But I don't think the fallout things, it's either not as bad as they thought it would be, or we're not there yet.
It's cost of living clearly right at the forefront of people's minds there, James, and a sort of weariness about the ability of anyone really to do anything about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. We heard inflation there. We also heard shrinkflation, you know, the sense that things, the servings in things or the size of things are getting smaller, you know, the five crisps in the crisp packet. That's certainly a frustration for people. And yeah, the government seems to be getting a fair bit of the blame for that. We obviously know that from the last few years. But they feel that the government are helpless to do anything about it, and that they're not doing a very good job generally. It's interesting, Matt. We see Number 10 and Rishi Sunak putting out these videos about, you know, the £300 or £800 they might save per month because of the government's tax changes. That had got cut through in these groups. Some people had said, you know, oh, they're doing things on the cost of living, £300. The problem is it had backfired for the Conservatives. And the reason is that they just thought that was really just a sort of a drop in the pan, you know, just a very small amount compared to what they needed. So it's actually actively unhelpful for them to be pushing that message. It almost looks a bit insulting that, you know, they're sort of saying, oh, we've saved you £300 when they've got all of these other cost pressures. One last thing, Matt, on that clip, the parties, Partygate. It's two years ago. It feels like ancient history in Westminster, but it's still on the voters' minds, those COVID parties still doing bad things for the Conservative brand.
I was thinking, actually, it's been a while since we've had a mention of Dominic Cummings and Barnard Castle, but maybe Partygate is the new Dominic Cummings of things that Westminster's forgotten about, but are still in people's minds. So to really distill things down, you asked them to mark Rishi Sunak's homework. How would they grade the government's performance?
C.
D.
F.
D.
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 Oh, five Ds, one C and one F. I mean, that sort of speaks for itself, really. Here they are then, summarising how they feel more broadly about Rishi Sunak.
Out of touch.
Incompetent.
A joke.
He did well when he wasn't fully in charge, but he now looks scared.
Untrustworthy.
Words rather than actions.
Fighting a losing battle.
Is a waste of time with the shoes and the trainers, with his shirt and T-shirt. I just think he's trying too hard. I just feel embarrassed and he just looks stupid.
I don't feel like he really understands what most people are going through, and yeah, you can't relate to that.
He lost out to Liz Truss and she resigned, and I just think folk thought, well, she did a rubbish job, I'm not being the next one to do a rubbish job. So no one run against him, so he's just kind of fallen into the position.
It just doesn't look like he's got an answer to a straightforward question.
Nothing's all one person's fault or one party's fault, but I think people are just tired.
It's a sense of disappointment in it, sort of running through that, James. That, you know, they thought he was quite good when he was Chancellor, you know, post Liz Truss, a sense of, you know, not living up to very particularly high expectations.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of feels like they feel like the job's almost a bit too big for him. And they get that sense that he's not as strong as he should be, that he's not as on top of it as he should be. Obviously, there is a very clear problem that, as one of the gentlemen said there was a five-point plan that Rishi Sunak outlined, and then he's not delivered against it. So that's obviously a pretty fundamental problem. But it's interesting, isn't it, too, on sort of the personality that Rishi Sunak gets across. And again, it's some of those social media videos, the trainers, the image that Rishi Sunak and Number 10 have tried to get across. It has gone down like a sort of cup of cold sick mat. They see right through it. They think it sort of looks, as one lady said, they're embarrassing and stupid. And it's not what they want to see from the PM. They don't believe he's down with the kids. And they don't want him to be down with the kids. They want him to sort of be strong and sort of take the lead on things rather than sort of trying to show off his fancy trainers. So I think that's a really important lesson. If I was Number 10 listening to this, I'd be thinking, for goodness sake, you know, let's stop doing these videos trying to show how cool Rishi is. We didn't persuade this lady in this focus group, and we're not going to persuade many other people either.
It's interesting because sometimes people in the Westminster will say, oh, it's just a Westminster bubble thing. It's a Twitter thing. No normal person even notices the trainers. But clearly they do. James, some breaking news to bring you. We've already had the first These People Are Morons message. No name on this one. It seems the majority of the focus groups are not very well informed and spout one or two headlines dependent on which newspaper headline they read. Just a reminder again, that is basically normal people. To the extent that they are aware of what's going on in politics, you know, they're worried about can they afford the weekly shop or whatever it might be. Isn't that right, James?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if you want to change the public's mind, then you know you go out and start a political party and start campaigning. This is how people see and view politics. They're not thinking about it every day like us weirdos. They are really not that engaged with it. And, you know, you might despair at that, but it's not ignorance. It's called leading a normal life.
OK, so let's go back to the group then. Clearly not great for Rishi Sunak. All Ds, C and an F. They don't like his trainers. He's not delivered. But do they think it's time to get rid of him? Do they agree with those Conservative rebels who've gone a bit quiet this week that actually they should remove Rishi Sunak and bring in a new leader?
I think that's the only way that they're going to regain votes is getting rid of him.
I think that's just another way of kind of brushing something under the rug.
How many prime ministers have we had in the last 2 years? I think they need to get them voted out and then like kind of regroup and then maybe come back in 4 years.
I don't think it'd be a good idea. Just there's no point.
Do any names come out to anybody? Anyone heard of anybody on the Conservative side who could be a good replacement?
Am I wrong in thinking Bojo's name's been thrown about? if I'm honest. I don't think he really got a fair run at it the first time.
Would Boris do a better job than Rishi now or not?
I think so, because they seem to find him more relatable.
I wouldn't mind him back. I thought he was quite good.
I think he's a bumbling fool, but I think he just needs someone to steady the ship for the next 4 or 5 years.
Well, so I know that listeners are about to explode, James, at the prospect of bringing Boris Johnson back. You asked him in a straight matchup between Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. Who do they prefer?
Boris. He is more personable and more believable as a leader.
Rishi, just more organised.
Out of the two, I think probably Rishi's got more brains.
Even though I don't have much time for Rishi, I think Rishi's better because Boris lied and he got proved to lie.
I'd have Boris Johnson back because, like I say, I think he's more relatable.
Boris Johnson, he seems to have a way with people, even though he's a bit silly.
Oh, did I make it? Is that 4-3, I think, to Sunak? Maybe 3-3 all? It was pretty close anyway, but you can take something from that, can't you?
Yeah, well, I think it's some caution needed. I mean, you know, the polling tends to show that the Conservative 2019 voters are keen to stay with Rishi Sunak at this stage. The current Conservatives in our most recent tracking poll at JL Partners has 75% of current Conservatives saying they shouldn't change leader. So I think it probably speaks to some of this group's frustration with Rishi Sunak. I'm not sure the sort of the Boris tsunami is waiting to come. But look, Nadine Dorris will be punching the air at that. And clearly, Boris Johnson does still have an appeal with some of these voters.
The debate about the quality of the focus group is raging. Lisa says, I do wish people would refrain from insulting focus group participants. I love this slot. Agree or disagree? It's always interesting to hear other people's opinions and always makes me think. Please continue, says Lisa, which is very nice. And then someone else, Chris says, what is wrong with these people? And Nick says, it's futile criticising the group, but you can't deny they're ignorant. No denying many of them are morons. So there we are. If you don't like
criticising them, but let's go criticise them anyway.
Yeah, we should just go studs up and criticise them anyway. Philip's just been in touch saying, don't you think you should say these people are paid to take part in these groups, which is in itself a self-selecting to a degree? Just explain that point, James, that when they sign up, they don't know what they're signing up for.
Yeah, exactly. They don't know what they're doing. And, you know, basically getting someone to sit down for 90 minutes without paying them an incentive would be pretty difficult. But in my view, that helps make it a more balanced sample because, you know, your average person who's quite happy to pay, you know, to make 40 quid for, you know, doing a Zoom call on a Tuesday evening is probably more normal than someone who would be willing to come and sit down for 90 minutes and do it for free. So No focus group, of course, can be perfect. No poll can be perfect, but we think it gets as close as we can to the average swing voter.
And the key thing is what you said is when they sign up to it, they've asked them questions, but they don't know what it's going to be about until they join the Zoom and James is.
Yeah, they could be talking about crisp packets, TV adverts, anything.
There we are. James, before we move on to the Labour Party, Andrew's been in touch. Well, Matt, looks like another biased focus group for the Sun Times Radio trying desperately to promote the loony Conservative Party. I'm not sure Andrew's actually listening.
I don't really know what to say to that, Matt. I guess keep listening, Andrew, because you'll see where they end up.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what you've taken from the first 15 minutes to reach that conclusion. But anyway, there we are. Right, we've done what the group thinks of Rishi Sunak. Remember, these are partly switchers, people who voted Conservative. They all voted Conservative at the last election. Some have switched to Labour. Others are undecided. In Isham, Walton, Wakefield and Bowie South. So this is what the group thinks of Keir Starmer.
Unclear.
Integrity.
Relatable.
Better than the two options.
I'd give him a go.
I'd say so.
Slimy. Just doesn't look trustworthy. The aura, just the way he is. I don't know, I just can't put my finger on it. It's like he's evil.
Yeah, he's quite slimy.
He gives me the creeps. I can't put my finger on it, but he makes my skin crawl. There's just something about him.
Definitely not Prime Minister material.
I don't think I've got much in common with Mr. Rishi, but feel like more relatable to him.
Well, I find a bit more relatable because he feels just a bit more normal. I just don't see the kind of smoke and mirrors that a lot of politicians use when they're in front of camera.
I wouldn't like him to be my next door neighbour.
The fact that he was a lawyer and he dealt with some pretty high profile cases. You know, obviously a lawyer can make a lot of money if he was to do that privately. But he chose to kind of do that in the public domain.
He's very quick jump on and say, well, how are you going to do this? How are you going to fund that? But he hasn't made any announcements on what their plan is.
So, remember, half the group are saying they're going to vote Labour. We'll come to that more specifically in a moment. James, when, and I know it's just the line to take to get into an interview, but when a Conservative goes on the radio and says, there's no love for Keir Starmer out there, I mean, this is a group, remember, some of these people are going to vote Labour. There is no love for him. I mean, you know, he's a bit more relatable, integrity, you know, better the two and all that. But then this, people get a weird vibe from him as well.
Yeah, and we've had this before. We've had smarmy, slimy, and we had evil there. I did challenge them in the group on that. I said, "Come on, guys, you know, you don't know this guy. How can he give you the creeps? How can he be the evil?" And their answer, you heard some of the answers there. You know, this sense of he gives this general aura of that sort of negative vibe. It's a really sort of hard thing to quantify, but. And explain why that is. But for whatever reason, whether it's in his public appearances, his speech, his mannerisms, he has given, to some extent, the British public a bit of the ick.
James, trying to pretend he's young there.
Exactly. Yeah. Call me out there, Matt. But you know, it's not enough of the ick to break up with him. You know, the Labour brand gets Keir Starmer over the fence. And I think that's a really important point, Matt, is that this isn't Corbyn. You know, they're not sort of over the moon with Keir Starmer, but it's not enough for them to say, you know, no way, I'm not touching him with a barge pole. They are ultimately will still come over to Labour, even despite Keir Starmer.
Now, another thing that came up, you mentioned Partygate was raised, which is all a bit retro. As you always do at the beginning of the session, you always ask them, what have you read in the news recently, just to sort of get them going and warmed up. And one person said she'd read on social media that Keir Starmer failed to prosecute Jimmy Savile when he was head of the Crown Prosecution Service. Now, this, the truth of it is, he was one of the Crown Prosecution Service, but he wasn't involved in that decision. But this has been raised before. I think Boris Johnson even raised it in the Commons at one point. So you asked her what she thought about it and whether the rest of the group had heard about this as well.
I have no idea if there's a lot of truth in it, but there must be something because it does keep getting rinsed and repeated. And I appreciate that we're probably coming up to an election, so somebody's fueling it from somewhere.
I have heard of it, but not recently. At the time, I seem to remember it being quite a valid reason as to why it didn't go any further than it did.
Well, I just don't believe anything I read in the news.
You never know what to believe.
I've not heard anything about it, but it would make me look it up now, because I am sort of heading towards voting Labour, which I normally wouldn't.
It's also been proven to be a doctored vote. Yeah,
he's looking
at Steve. Yeah. So it's obviously, this is the thing, like, they play games with you.
And you almost think it's a bit of kind of digging up old stuff again to try and throw muck at somebody.
So, James, I suppose this is a reminder that things, I mean, for her to have read it this week and thought that was the sort of thing that was uppermost in her mind, it's a reminder that stuff is circulated, particularly on social media. People are seeing it in their social media feeds alongside news feeds and everything else. And so stuff is in the ether that isn't on the 10 o'clock news.
Absolutely. And I think later this year at the election, we will see this play a role. It's interesting. She brought that up at the start of the focus group, Matt, when I asked, what have you heard in the news recently? And I think it's fair to say a lot's been going on, but that was the thing she mentioned. So, you know, she's seen that on social media. It is going to be important. It is going to play a role. You know, it might be relatively easy for Labour to knock down. You heard some of the arguments people were using there. Is it just fake news? You heard a chap there. He actually looked it up live during the focus group and Googled Starmer Savile. I did it myself afterwards, and it does show you a fact check article that sort of says, oh, a picture was photoshopped or whatever. He then took that to mean, you know, the whole thing was nonsense. So, if I were Labour, I would say, you know, the fake news line clearly works quite well as a means of dispelling it. But like you said there, someone who hadn't heard about it said, oh, you know, that might make me feel a bit differently about Starmer. And however much people say they'll look up information, they often don't. So I would expect this to play a role in the campaign. I'm not saying it's going to be a huge game changer, but I think we will hear a lot more about this in focus groups over the coming weeks and months.
And there's the reality of the way that people are consuming the news now. Well, let's move on then and ask, you asked the group how they would vote if the election was being held today.
Tory, mostly because I really couldn't see myself voting for Keir Starmer.
Labour, I think they just deserve a chance.
Labour, because I don't want to keep the Conservative in.
Labour, I guess, at the moment, just for a change.
I would vote Labour because I think out of all the parties, they are the ones that resonate mostly with me.
Labour, just to see if they can make anything different.
Labour. The main reason for that is change.
Is there anything in your back of your mind that you would describe as your main hesitation about voting Labour? Anything that would stop you being 10 out of 10 sure?
No, I just want something different.
Is Keir Starmer the one for the job?
Keir Starmer may not be the best person to be number one.
The only reservation I have is I just haven't seen any detail.
Is Keir Starmer strong enough to be Prime Minister?
And I suppose that's the value of these focus groups, James, is you're digging under those big leads in the polls and what's driving it, and any hesitations or concerns, or, you know, there is no enthusiasm for Keir Starmer, whatever it might be. That's what we're picking up there.
Yeah. And if you were doing these focus groups for a political party, that's what you'd want to find out about your opponent, even if they're ahead. You know, what are the little sort of chinks of concern that I can exploit as a political party? Look, I think the first thing to say is that despite all of their other hesitations about Starmer, that sense of it's time for a change, they deserve a chance, is still the most powerful thing. And I think that when we're looking at the polls and we're looking at those leads, whether it's 30-point lead with YouGov, 15-point lead with JL Partners, lots of others in the middle, that whole spread, I think what is behind that Labour lead is that sense, not of, goodness me, you know, sign me up for the Starmer show, but actually a sense of it's time for a change. We need to get these guys out. We need to give someone else a chance. And that is the key sort of theme that's going on. Yes, there are hesitations in there. I would expect the Conservatives to major quite heavily on Starmer come the campaign. I'd expect them to major quite heavily on a lack of detail, a lack of planning that they will say that Labour doesn't have. But it's that change sense that is really driving things at the moment.
And obviously, one of Rishi Sunak's reactions, because this was carried out Tuesday night, so post the local elections, there's obviously been a big debate around what the local elections tell us. Downing Street seizing on this idea that there might be a hung parliament, although if the YouGov poll with 30-point lead is to be believed, then that would seem unlikely. But keen to talk that up, a coalition of chaos of Labour relying on the SNP and the Greens and the Lib Dems and all of that. So you asked the group whether they had an appetite for a coalition government.
I think for me, a coalition, not the best. I'd rather just one or the other than just getting sort stuff out.
When there's a coalition, there's too much sniping and arguing and everybody wanting their party's policies to go through rather than doing what's best.
They just won't be able to agree, will they?
I think their focus and their time will be spent more on infighting.
No matter who, even if it's the best idea for the country, they'll go, it wasn't our decision, it wasn't our idea, so we're going to vote against it.
So, James, what should Downing Street take from that?
Well, I think that, you know, that when that coalition of chaos line got briefed to the papers the other day, it got lots of sort of people mocking it on Twitter. Is this all they've got? But I think listening to that, you know, if the Conservatives can persuade the public, and it's a big if, that there could be a hung parliament, it may help them shore up their position, because there is that real concern about sort of sniping, arguing and so on. This was actually the thing that energised the group the most, this sense of too many cooks spoil the broth. Is it just going to be lots of voices rather than just one? It's less chaos, more inaction. They fear that nothing's going to get done if there's a hung parliament. So, look, if the Conservatives can make this case, then it could well be persuasive come a campaign. Of course, one thing we didn't test here that it would be interesting to look at in more detail in future is actually, does that help Labour? Because can Labour also say, well, we will be a one-party government and you need to make sure you get us over the line? So it could work the other way, but at the moment, I think it's fair to say that the hung parliament is a genuine concern about people. They don't necessarily believe it will happen yet. But if I were the Tories, I think that, you know, ignore the Twitter sniping about that line. It helped them in 2015.
Yeah.
It helped them in 2019. It might just help them in 2024.
But it's really interesting. But Labour's biggest, well, one of Labour's problems is complacency and people assuming that other people will vote for them. Actually, it helps them if it sounds like it might be now. Let's look at their slogans, the very slogans. And we saw a lot of this, you know, being played out and trialled during the local elections. Here's Labour's slogan: stop the chaos, turn the page and give Britain its future back.
Well, they're all going to say that, oh, let's go back and do it how we did it when we were in. You know, it's just another way of slandering other parties.
I see that's looking to the future and they're saying, right, let's close the book on what's happened in the past, just turn the page and go to the future.
I mean, I like to stop the chaos. I'm not sure about turn the page being a phrase.
that last one, all the turning the page and new chapters and all that, I find very confusing as to where you are in the book. And then you come to the Tories, they're pushing the line, stick with the plan that's working.
Which plan's that?
And what's working?
What those exact plans and points are, I couldn't tell you.
I mean, that's not great, is it, James, if your slogan triggers a laugh?
Yeah, no, it's a terrible slogan. It dies on impact because, as you heard there, what plan and what's working. So, yeah, I'd probably change that one.
Finally, then, you asked, as ever, what their messages be, this group of swing voters and undecideds. First of all, what would their message, if they could speak directly to Rishi Sunak, what would they say to him?
Plan the long fight because you're going to lose this one.
Wake up and smell the coffee.
Just try living like one of your constituents.
Close the door on your way out.
If they're going to be in opposition, just work together and don't just be the opposition for opposition's sake.
And finally, their message to Keir Starmer.
Are you a Freemason?
He can get out as well.
Just don't mess it up.
Work for the people.
Listen to the normal person out,
Don't screw it up.
So, James, we'll do them both. But first of all, if you were back in number 10 in your old job advising Rishi Sunak now, what would you suggest?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that this feels more like majority territory than hung parliament territory, doesn't it? These voters seem pretty convinced by Labour. Rishi Sunak, I think, you know, they need to obviously make a lot of those concerns and frustrations that people have about Keir Starmer. I think, you know, amping up the hung parliament language as much as possible. You can see why they're doing that, because it's a big concern for people. I think trying to pivot Rishi Sunak away from the fun, silly social media videos and onto what's his serious plan for the country, there might be a dividing line there, because some people do feel like Keir Starmer doesn't have a plan.
But maybe not say that the current plan is working, because they seem to laugh at that. So what's the message then to Keir Starmer that he should take from this?
Well, look, I think he's in a good position. I think focusing on change certainly helps him. I think he still needs to do some work on his image, making sure that when people tune back in come the election, they are doing everything they can to make sure that, you know, they've done their research on sort of when does Keir Starmer come across best, which setting should they put him in, to try and diffuse some of those concerns about them, him perhaps giving them the creeps or them, even worse, thinking he's evil. So that's one thing when they tune back in. And the other thing, I think, is detail. You don't want to drown the public in policy. But those three or four big things, we've said it for months on here, haven't we, Matt? You know, they want to see some flesh on the bones, and they are worried about the lack of a plan from Labour. So a couple of big ticket plans that are relatable, but also are bold, I think that's really important over the coming months for Labour.
That's it for the focus group. We'll be back with another one next month. Let me know what you think of all of that. You can email me, matt@times.radio. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.